The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to another Slate spoiler special. I'm Aisha Harris, Slate culture writer and host of Represent, and this week we're spoiling Black Panther.
Shuri!
Brother!
Turn on the train on the bottom track!
The stabilizers won't activate your suit! You won't have protection!
Neither will he!
Okay!
Here to talk with me about the film are Slate's chief political correspondent, Jamel Bowie. Hello, Jamel.
Hi, Aisha.
And Represent producer, my producer, Vera Lynn Williams. Hello, Vera Lynn.
Hey, girl. Hey.
Okay, so this is probably the most anticipated cultural event for Black people of the year. It's a big friggin' deal. And before we even get into spoiling it, I would love to just hear y'all's initial thoughts. Now, I know Jamel and Verilyn, you saw it more recently than I have. It's been like more than a week since I've seen it. So, you know, I'm still basking in the glow of everything, but it's not as fresh in my mind as it is for you. So, Verilyn, why don't we start with you?
I went in like very, like I was excited, but I was also trying to remind myself not to go in with too high expectations because I was like a little nervous about being disappointed. And I can honestly say that exceeded my expectations. And I'm sitting here trying to like, you know, we're like cool critics, like we shouldn't be excited about things. But this movie was so beautiful. It was, the storyline stayed with me the whole time. I'm not a huge superhero fan because I sometimes feel like there's a lot of kicking and screaming and action stuff and not enough dialogue. It didn't disappoint on that level. And, you know, just as someone that, you know, I'm Sierra Leonean American, and so it just tackled deep issues that I wasn't really expecting from a superhero film.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jamel?
I was also very enthusiastic about it upon leaving the theater. I've been thinking a lot about it, but because I've been writing about it for Slate, but also just my own kind of trying to absorb what I witnessed. And the two things that stand out the most to me about the movie are that I don't think I've seen a world this fully realized on screen, at least not in a superhero movie, ever. I think I've seen the vast majority of films in the genre of superhero movie, and there's just nothing like Wakanda in its visual style and the fact that it lives and breathes like any other character in the movie. That to me is just completely striking. The second thing is just how political this movie is.
Yeah.
I was not expecting that whatsoever. But I think this is like, you know, most superhero movies deal either not in ideas at all, or they either deal with ideas in this very sort of like high conceptual way, like with the Nolan Batman movies. But I feel like Black Panther is actually dealing with concrete political ideas in a provocative way. I'll be very interested to see how sort of mainstream movie-going audiences react to them.
Yeah, the politics is something we can definitely get into. I was also struck by that. And I walked away with it thinking, like, there are going to be some white people who are going to be not happy with this movie.
Yeah, I said, like, were there any white women besides the one that dies right at the top in the film, the whole film? I don't think so.
No, and there were only really two prominent white guys involved, which was also
the villain and the token, which usually is reserved for the people of color.
Right. So this was very much, you know, unlike other, you know, superhero movies, I think. I mean, Jamel, you are definitely by far, I think, out of all of us, the one who's most aware of these things. But it does seem like this was definitely a case where they went into a completely different world. I think maybe the Thor movies are also similar to that, where they're like in a completely different world. It's not in like necessarily, it's not all taking place here in America. And there's no real crossover with the other Marvel movies. It just kind of stands on its own. So I really appreciated that.
Well, I mean, and I'll say the thing is that, you know, the Thor movies also take place in a fantastical world, Asgard. The Guardians of the Galaxy movies take place in outer space. But, like, neither Asgard feels very sterile in those movies. And the Guardians of the Galaxy films are taking place sort of not in sterile landscapes, but they're in space. They're in spaceships. It's a very kind of contained, closed world. And thinking to other franchises as well, there really is nothing like kind of the scope of Wakanda, and the extent to which every time Wakanda's on screen, something is happening in every little corner of the frame. The closest comparison point I had for it, honestly, is the first Star Wars movie, in terms of a cinematic world that feels completely lived in.
And by that you mean A New Hope, not
right.
Okay, got it. So
no, yeah, I do not mean the prequels,
or The Force Awakens, which could, like,
no.
There's yeah. So let's actually just get into the nitty gritty of what's happening here and what exactly Wakanda is and what it means. And you know, I think it's safe to say that even if you're not familiar, I can say as someone who like has not seen any of the Captain Americas, so like this is my first introduction to Black Panther, the character,
same
on screen at all. Because Chadwick Boseman popped up in the last was it the last Avengers?
It was the last Captain America movie, Captain America Civil War.
Right. So I feel safe saying that even if you're not familiar with it, you will go in and it does a good job, I think, of setting things up. I think to some extent to its detriment, that was one of my issues with it, was it felt like it took a while to get into the beginning of it. But let's actually just start off with where it begins. And Jamel, I will volley that over to you since you have read all of the, you haven't read all of them, but you've read, you're familiar with Black Panther, the comic, and how that translates from there to the screen.
Right. So the movie begins with sort of a quick prehistory of Wakanda. Wakanda is a Central African nation, very tiny. Sometime in the distant past, a meteor that was made of a fictional material called vibranium hits the location where Wakanda is, and the tribes that are in that location join together, all but one tribe, the Jabari tribe, which pops up as a plot point in the movie. Joined together to build a civilization sort of centered around this metal. This metal basically is magic in the Marvel universe. It's virtually indestructible. It can become all kinds of different kinds of other materials, can be woven in materials, and it sort of has special properties that the Wakandans have basically figured out over the course of the thousands of years they've been using it and studying it. It's sort of worth noting that in the context of the Marvel Universe, Captain America's shield, which also is a strangely magical creation, is made of vibranium. So
I thought about that. I'm like, so the white superhero secret weapon was made from stolen vibranium? How is that? Is that brought in any way in Captain America that is from Wakanda?
No, it's not really touched on. I think it's touched on in the first Captain America, or maybe Iron Man 2. It's some very minor point in one of the earlier movies. But and this hasn't really been addressed, I think, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but in the comic books, it is sort of canon that, yeah, during the Second World War, vibranium was stolen from Wakanda, and that's what became Captain America's shield. Anyway, so the very beginning of the movie just kind of rushes through. This is what Wakanda is. This is what the Black Panther is. It's the protector of Wakanda. It gets its powers from a special herb, represents the Panther God. And then after that quick prehistory, we are dropped in Oakland, California in 1992. And that's where the film really takes off.
Right. And we have our first glimpse of one of the many stars in this movie. There are so many stars. And that is Sterling K. Brown, who is playing the king's brother, King T'Chaka, who is Black Panther's father. He's playing the king's brother. And he it seems like he's like hoarding guns or something. He's doing something illegal with another character who we will later find out who that character is.
Well, like this is in the midst of you know, I want to say like maybe like the Rodney King like riot eras. Am I correct in making that assumption, Jamel?
Well, 92.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's not in L.A., right? It's in
Oakland.
Right, it's quite ways away, but that's the atmosphere. Yeah,
it's a clear scene. It's a scene that's clear. Like he is like a black power revolutionary of some sort. So. Someone does a knock on the door, and then the other guy that's with him looks out the door, looks out the people, and he said, "What did he say? The two?
There are two. What does he say?
What does he say? Well,
he says there are two. There are two. Why can't I remember her name? It's the actress.
Oh, Grace Jones.
Yeah,
Grace Jones.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a knock at the door, and the friend of Sterling K. Brown's character in Jobo. He's like, yo, there's two Grace Jones looking chicks outside. And so
one of many beautiful lines.
And so, of course, Njobo's like, oh, well, you better not make them knock twice. They're not going to knock twice. And they open the door and in comes these beautiful black women wearing African garb and
designed by the one and only Ruth Carter.
Yes.
Who's been on the show.
Who's been on Represent. Yes. And they enter with T'Chaka, and T'Chaka is upset because Njobo has been going behind his back and apparently has been. This is what I wasn't very clear about, like what exactly he was trying to do.
Well, my understanding is that he is the inside person that got the vibranium stolen. Like he was how they figured out how to steal the vibranium from Wakanda.
Okay, got it. So
he was in Oakland as sort of one of basically Wakanda's emissary spies. They're kind of keeping an eye on things and kind of reporting back to Wakanda because Wakanda sort of cloistered away from the world.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is the first time we see. So something that we see throughout the movie is people revealing that they are actually Wakandans, because there's a little confusion sometimes or deceptiveness happening. And so Sterling K. Brown and the other characters will peel back their bottom lip to reveal this sort of like code, you know, like a barcode,
like a
glowing barcode. It's not a barcode, but it kind of looks like one. And that reveals that, yes, they are Wakandans. And it turns out that Sterling K. Brown's friend is also a Wakandan and had actually been spying on Njobo for T'Chaka. And so then what happens? I'm like totally blanking.
And then he, you know, he's like, you betrayed us. I can't, you have to go. We're going to take you back so you can, you know, face the whoever to get your judgment. And Njobo goes to kill Forrest Whitaker's, what's his name?
The actor is Denzel Whitaker.
Okay, Denzel Whitaker's character, who has been spying on Njobo, Sterling K. Brown's character.
So he goes to kill the person that's been spying on him. And T'Chaka is not having it and ends up killing his own brother. And then he leaves him there.
It should be noted, or two things should be noted. The first is that Sterling K. Brown's character hadn't just helped someone steal some vibranium, but the thief, a character named Ulysses S. Claw, ended up killing a bunch of Wakandans in the course of the theft. And so Sterling K. Brown is sort of helped assist a really horrendous act of terrorism in Wakanda. And the second thing is that witnessing the Wakandan ship arrive in Oakland is a little boy, who it's revealed is Sterling K. Brown's character's son. Yeah.
Yes. So that takes us to like only the first 10 minutes of this movie. So let's keep going. So we cut to then the present day.
And then we're in Wakanda, or not quite Wakanda, a Wakandan aircraft carrying T'Challa, the Black Panther, played by Chadwick Boseman, and his general, the chief of the Royal Guard in Wakanda, Okoye, played by Danai Gurira, who stars in The Walking Dead. And they are on their way on some kind of mission. And we find out that what the mission is T'Challa is trying to contact and retrieve a spy, Nakia, played by Lupita Nyong'o, who herself is in the midst of a mission, what it looks like trying to save some women from human trafficking. And what ensues is the first kind of taste of action in the movie. The Black Panther drops down from the ship kind of startles the convoy of soldiers. Together with Nakia, they save these women, stop these soldiers, and Nakia is brought on the ship, where she's informed that T'Chaka, T'Challa's father, the king, has passed away, has died. And this is what happened in the previous movie, Captain America Civil War. It kind of is the inciting incident of that movie, in that T'Challa will be about to take place and about to perform the ceremony that would elevate him to the throne of Wakanda.
So, yeah, a lot happens. We have T'Challa returning to Wakanda with Okoye and Nakia, and they're being greeted by the wonderful Angela Bassett, who is playing his mother. Mm. And they are also greeted by his sister, who is
Suri, played by Letitia Wright, who's new, and it was such a breath of fresh air. Like,
well, she was delightful.
She clearly stole basically this entire movie.
Yeah.
she's kind of the very spunky, very smart sister who designs his she's the tech wizard, so she's designing all the weapons, designing the suit for her brother.
And she says just because something is good doesn't mean you can't make it better, and I was just like, that is like a word.
She's just so delightful, and it's great to see that sort of that banter with the two of them. The other thing we realize is that we should talk about the sort of like love romance between Nakia and Black Panther, where, you know, it's we also see in the scene that they've had a thing in the past and maybe there might be a thing happening again, but we never really find out like what exactly like tore them apart before.
Well, I think it's the first rumblings of the political tension, but you know, like, she wants to be out there doing good, helping other Africans
outside of Wakanda,
whereas T'Challa, who was the heir to the throne and now is about to become king, is way more concerned with Wakandans and making sure that, you know, where they live is taken care of.
Can I just add real quickly that, you know, in the lead up to this, we see these great aerial vistas of Wakanda. We see the Wakandan countryside. We see the city.
We see baskets, the African baskets that you see in every African market today, which was so cool to see.
Right. But what is kind of crazy about this movie is that it's not just a superhero movie. It also is sort of, you could easily spin it off into like an African Game of Thrones, because the meeting of the royal family and this kind of sparks the period where we're meeting various members of the royal court.
Yes.
When T'Challa takes part in the ceremony where he becomes king, we are introduced to this wide range of characters from every region of Wakanda, and each one of them is someone who I would happily watch a movie about.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So essentially, now that T'Chaka has passed, he is going to be the heir to the throne. But before he becomes the heir, we have to see if he's going to be challenged by someone else from either the Wakandan, from either their tribe or from other tribes. And so it's really, really beautiful the way it's set up, and this like sort of it's on a cliff that's kind of encaved, and there you see all the families, the different tribes,
different garbs, different colors,
different markings on their bodies for depending on what tribe they're on. And we spend a decent amount of time like in this like moment of him being challenged. And so it's the Jabari tribe, correct?
Yeah, the Jabari tribe that ultimately from the mountains,
that one of their members actually challenges Black Panther. And watching that scene, I was actually like, how is this movie rated PG-13? Because it was like very brutal.
I have my criticisms of some of the action in this movie, especially towards the end, but this would be the second action sequence. This fight scene is brutal and intimate, and I was legitimately sort of like a bit disturbed throughout at how genuinely threatened T'Challa felt in the midst of it.
Yeah. Mm. It was I feel like it was a bit much for me, and I usually am totally fine with these types of action sequences, but I think part of it is just the fact that and this says a lot about me and also just the way we view violence in film and TV, but like usually when we see violence, it's like high-tech weapons, it's guns, it's blah blah blah. But with this, it was just like, it's fists, it's spears, it's like you're seeing you're seeing things go into bodies and pounding of head I don't watch Game of Thrones, but I imagine this is kind of what Game of Thrones is like. It felt very Game of Thronesy in terms of the type of violence we were witnessing.
I think that it was also something about like the value of life, you know, something about the way that they were fighting made you see that like every hit, every punch, every thrust was like for a purpose, whereas in other action movies where like someone gets shot and then they die and then you move on, it kind of like lessens that person's value in the world. And there was something about the way that they were fighting that made me like acknowledge that if somebody were to die, it would be through like a purpose driven motive, you know. And spoiler, but this is the spoiler special. He doesn't die. He almost kills the Jabari challenger and then
M'Baku,
but he spares his life.
Two quick thoughts. First, my friends, you guys are describing the wonderful thing about good action choreography.
I know.
Like, really?
I know.
truly good action choreography isn't just showing fighting. It's showing character. It's showing, it's helping advance plot story, and story. Yeah. And so we learned something about both T'Challa and M'Baku through the fight. And you don't really see that very often in these kinds of movies. The second thing I want to say is that M'Baku is kind of an infamous character in Black Panther lore. In the comic books, especially in the original issues in the 60s, he was a character called Man-Ape, which is as iffy as...
Well, in the movie, they also wear the gorilla, like they're gorillas,
that's their chant, right?
And what I really admired about the movie is that they were able to take this character who, in his original form, is kind of racist, and actually like not just transform him, but make him and his tribe and his people sort of a part of this coherent world, and a part of this world that, while they seem threatening, are fundamentally of it. And not some sort of weird caricature. Because, like, I could easily imagine in much lesser hands this just being disastrous.
Yeah, yeah.
So he spares his life. He spares M'Baku's life. And Black Panther is now the king. And so I guess now is the point where, if I remember correctly, where we get the sort of the weaving in of Michael B. Jordan's character.
The very good-looking Michael B. Jordan.
Yes, yes. Wearing those beautiful glasses, those eyeglasses he was wearing. So Michael B. Jordan's character is Eric Killmonger. He helps steal vibranium from a museum in London. And soon Okoye is, I think she's alerted.
T'Challa's king, and the Wakandan sort of royal court is informed that vibranium has been found out in the world, and that it's in the possession, and they don't know about Killmonger yet. None of that is known to them. What they know is that vibranium's been found in the world, and it's in the possession of Claw, their old nemesis. And here is when we sort of get a bit of conflict within the court. One of the members of the court, played by Daniel Kaluuya, who is in the film a close friend of T'Challa, his family died in the terrorist attack perpetrated by Claw years back. And so he agrees that T'Challa should don the Black Panther garb and go after Claw. And he says to him, you either need to kill him or bring him back for justice. There's no other choice here. And this sets up kind of our next big action set piece, which takes place in Busan, South Korea.
Yeah, I loved this montage. I thought it was really, really great. And it was also great to, like, again, this is one of, it's so rare, I feel like, to see these types of movies where white people are just in the background. But, like, for them to, like, go, you have these, like, African people going to South Korea, and the way they interact, and they know, well, Nakia knows her way around because she obviously like gets out more than the other ones do, and so she goes and she actually knows where the vibranium is gonna, where Claw is gonna be, and it's like a sort of, not a speakeasy per se, but it's sort of like a secret. You have to know a code or know the woman at the front who's like
selling fish.
Like, it's a market outside, and then like inside it's this giant like Casino Royale type of deal, and so this is where the deal is, the exchange is supposed to go down between Claw and the person who's going to buy it. by the vibranium. And I just thought that, like, see, it felt very, in a way, James Bondy, because they were all, they had, like, they were talking to each other, communicating to each other via, you know, like,
some kind of ear,
yeah, some kind of Bluetooth or whatever. And just like, I have eyes on, and I have eyes on her. Look, like 12 o'clock, blah, blah, blah.
And here is where we meet our other token white person, Everett K. Ross, played by Martin Freeman, who is a CIA agent from the United States. And he's actually the person that is buying the vibranium from Claw. And immediately he recognizes T'Challa when he walks in. And he's like, what are you doing here? And I guess Jamel, do they meet in a different series? I got the sense that he knew that he was Black Panther. He knew that he, like, dressed up in a suit.
Yes. Captain America Civil War, which came out in 2016, is kind of the prequel for this movie in a lot of ways. I actually recommend watching it if you haven't. It's pretty good. It's, I think, a top-tier Marvel movie. And there's sort of three plot lines in the movie. There's three plot lines. And the B plot is about T'Challa and Black Panther, him hunting down the Winter Soldier, who he believes killed his father. And so in all of that, Martin Freeman's character is introduced in that film, and that's how they meet. That's sort of the backstory there.
Okay. That's good to know.
So, yeah, Everett's not happy that Black Panther's there. He's blowing up his spot. And eventually what happens is Claw shows up. He has the vibranium in a suitcase. He, like, makes a weird crack. Oh, he walks in with, like, four or five other people, like, these guys, like, big hulking guys. And Everett says to him, like, what, are you, like, releasing a mixtape or something? Is this your entourage? I love that part. And then eventually, like, the deal does not go as planned. And we get an intense, shootout, fight out between Nakia and Okoye and Black Panther, which turns into a giant chase scene that I also thought was really, really, like, well played.
You had highly entertaining.
Yes, there were multiple cars happening. You had Okoye and Nakia in one car, and Black Panther was sort of like jumping on jumping from car to car.
No, he was in a car that was being controlled by his sister in Wakanda.
That's probably worth explaining, like, is the fact that it's sort of like
virtual reality kind of,
yeah, or just being able to teleport
remote control
exactly.
This is a lot less technology. remote control
Rosuri was in Wakanda, but she was remote controlling a car, and so he was in the car, Black Panther was in the car alongside her, and so a chase ensues between them that I thought was just really well done myself personally.
It was car chases, I feel like, are hard to do. A lot of them are kind of poorly edited, and don't really get a sense of motion and who's where and what they're doing. But I thought this was a very competently directed car chase. And it was a great showcase for everyone. You saw what Claw could do. You got a taste of the Black Panther's agility and strength. There's a great moment where the car he is on is about to run into a wreck, and he jumps to the side of the car and uses his strength and weight to sort of give it a sharp cut left at full speed to keep on with the chase.
It reminded me of a sort of like sailing a boat. In a way, or like, I don't know why, but I thought of Moana. I was like, it's like Moana, where she's like,
you would think of a Disney movie.
Well, look, this is a Disney movie too. Anyway.
And Okoye has some really great moments too. Using her spear to take out Mars. And,
planting that spear in like the ground. And yeah, it was great.
After the chase, they're able to stop Claw, and T'Challa is actually about to kill him right there. But there are people watching, so he takes him to sort of like a CIA holding cell where they interrogate him, where Everett interrogates him to kind of get a handle on what's going on. And I actually really love this scene, because it's sort of where Everett realizes that what he believes about Wakanda isn't quite Right.
Well, I mean, it was so interesting because he's like the idea that he believed it. It was such a, to me, that was also kind of like a signposting of sorts. It's just like, he's just like, there's no way, you know, there's no way that what you're saying is true. That's one of the poorest countries. And it, to me, it was just like he like represented America.
Well, the thing they keep saying is you're a third world country.
Yeah.
And that to me was like that's what they're saying. It's a third world country. That's what everyone thinks. I mean, to be fair, it seems like, of course, they're going to think that because T'Chaka has done such a good job of keeping it from most people. Like, that's his whole MO, is like, we don't want other people to know that we even have this. Like, he's very isolationist policy. Am I reading that wrong, Jamel?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think it's like the possibility of it. Like, maybe I'm getting a little like.
Verlyn, I think you're right too.
I think it goes both ways.
It's clearly meant to. It's not just sort of a reflection of how well T'Chaka has been able to conceal Wakandan wealth and power, but that Everett Ross is incredulous. He's like, it's not just that they're a third world country, but that they're a third world African country.
Yes.
And I think that subtext is clearly there.
Yeah. So after we have this exchange between Black Panther and Everett, where he's like surprised that this could even exist, that vibranium could even exist, or that even that Wakandans would be able to harvest it and all that stuff, Claw actually gets like busted out of his cell, or from the holding cell, by Killmonger and his group of cronies or whatever. And so he escapes, and actually Black Panther sees him running as he's leaving, and he sees like a necklace he's wearing, and the necklace has I guess some sort of symbol.
It was a ring.
It was a ring.
It's the same ring.
It's a ring belonging to his grandfather.
Right. So all of a sudden, he thinks either, like, it could be two things. It could be either something, like, is amiss, this guy's actually Wakandan, or he stole it from someone else. So we get that glimpse of that, and eventually we see Killmonger winds up killing, or we think, we don't actually see him die, so who knows, he could come back. But we see him.
Oh, he better be dead.
Claw?
No, he is dead, because he brings him back to Wakanda. He's dead.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind.
Well, before that, when T'Challa sees the ring, he, you know, goes to confront Forrest Whitaker's character and is like, you know, tell me the truth. And he's like, I promise never to speak of, you know, what happened in the 90s with his dad. He's like, I promise never to speak of it. And he's like, I am your king. And then he essentially makes him tell him the story of how his T'Challa's father kills his brother and abandons Killmonger, who was his son.
Right.
Yeah. So Killmonger is T'Challa's cousin.
Yes. So we kind of realize, I mean, I guess we realize it with the ring, but like the reality of it happens to T'Challa at the same time that Killmonger brings Claw's body to Wakanda. And it's pretty much like I did something that your kin couldn't even did. I brought Claw here dead. And now I'm going to challenge. I'm going to claim my seat at the throne. And at first, everyone was kind of like, yeah, whatever, get out of here. And then he's like, ask me who I am. And so there was a lot of like, for me, it was like a lot of like notes to like African norms and traditions, you know, like who hasn't heard a Nigerian say, do you know who I am? You know, like just this idea of like, I am the Seta Set, like that idea. I feel like there was like a lot of like speaking to this, the mannerisms of like Africanness and what I kind of like recognized as like those African mannerisms throughout, and that like blew my mind. And that was like another example of that. He was just like ask me who I am. And then finally one of the guards in the like high council member say, who are you, right before he gets thrown out. And he said, and then he like riddles off all the names of who he is.
Right. And then they're all bewildered. And one of probably my favorite line of the whole thing, Michael B. Jordan and Angela Bassett, who, as we mentioned earlier, plays Black Panther's mother. She's like, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
And she's making a face. And Michael B. Jordan's like, hi, auntie.
Yes.
And I love that moment. It's like, he said, auntie, it's so funny. I love it. So then we get another scene, this time with Killmonger fighting T'Challa. Only this time it's even more brutal because it's we know this backstory. We know that, and not that we didn't know that the M'Baku, the Jabari fighter who fought him earlier, like, he obviously wanted it too. Like, it's a life or death situation. But we have all of this backstory that we didn't necessarily have with Jabari. We get the Jabari backstory a little bit later in another scene. But that scene was also brutal. And essentially what happens is that Black Panther loses.
Here, Killmonger is saying, I have been in America, like, living as a Black American, having to, like, navigate this white structure and learning their ways. He was in the CIA himself. Like, you know, he's like, I had to navigate all these struggles, and here you are in Wakanda with all your fancy equipment and all your fancy technology, and you're doing nothing for people who are us that are out there. And so this fight is almost like the tension between, like, that tension of that conversation, which I've, like, thought about throughout my life, because growing up as a Black presenting girl in the Bronx that's Sierra Leonean and, like, not feeling Sierra Leonean enough and not feeling Black enough, like, that fight, I felt like, represented that fight.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm a regular American Black person.
You Black.
But I've, like, I mean, my African heritage, you know, the last African in my family was brought here in, like, the 1830s. Before that, actually, because the slave trade was over by then, or the American slave trade. Anyway, I said earlier that I thought this was a provocative movie, and this is sort of what I mean, because I feel like in the conversation leading up to the film, lots of conversation about Wakanda, lots of conversation about what the idea of Wakanda means to people of African descent, Black Americans or otherwise, sort of this uncolonized, technologically advanced, powerful nation. But the film, I think, very smartly brings up the other side of that, which is Killmonger's point that if this existed, where the hell have they been? Why have they abandoned the African diaspora? Why have they allowed, countless people to suffer and die under racist oppression? And Killmonger's argument to T'Challa and the Wakandan court is that you are wrong, you are immoral, and I will. If I become king, I will use this country's power to right what's wrong. And sort of the other side of that is, it's sort of almost like a genocidal thing. He wants to wipe out everyone else and dominate and rule over the planet. He says at one point the empire will never set on the Wakandan Empire, which is directly taken from, you know, the empire never set, never, the sun never set on the British Empire. But watching it, I was like, you know, is he wrong?
No. And I saw him as, like, sort of a mirror of Nakia, in terms of, like, they both have the same goals in a way of, like, we need to be helping other nations and other people who look like us because they need us. We can't just keep pretending that, like, there aren't all these problems out there. But then he just goes and takes it in a completely wrong direction. Like, he's, like, basically the Azalea Banks of this movie, where, like, he says things that, like, make a lot of sense, but then he goes about it all the wrong way, or, like, wraps it up in, like, this rhetoric that, like, borders on Hotep and is just sort of, like, uncomfortable. Even if you agree with him, it's kind of uncomfortable to watch, because you're like, you just want to, in a way, destroy the world. Like, you want to watch the world burn. You can understand why he wants to, because he's very, there's the personal aspect too of him literally being abandoned.
But there's also the idea that, like, you know, if Wakanda had opened up their doors and helped, you know, other African nations or African people from around the diaspora, would they be Wakanda, right? And that's something that I was thinking a lot about, is just, like, when Everett was, you know, at some point ends up having to come to Wakanda to be healed, because he gets shot during the Claw is being freed from the jail. And so they bring him to Wakanda. And the first thing Shuri says when she sees him, like, hello, colonizer, or whatever she says, which is, like, that's the truth. Like, it's like, once you have someone that knows this, like, they're going to want it. And, you know, if you want to get into, like, why, you know, this, like, I'm reading Yaya's book, I forget her last name, but it's Homecoming. And that gets into, like, the Ghanaian, like what happened at the Gold Coast during slavery, and how was it able to, like, what role did Africans play in it, and like how did the British pit different tribes against each other and get them to essentially sell their people into slavery, right? And so there's this question of what happened. Why is it that African countries are some of the richest and well-resourced countries in the world? And so what happened? Colonizers came in and did their thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to Jamel's point, I think about it being provocative, I think what the movie winds up doing, because we obviously see Black Panther wrestling with this and wrestling with the... He knows in a way, you can tell, he knows in a way that in many ways Killmonger is right. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the movie, he's successfully killed. I think he's killed. Because again, this one, I'm sure, like, who knows, he could have died, maybe not, because we don't see Killmonger's body after this. And I know how these movies work sometimes. So he could just pop up again. But he offers to spare, like, he offers to, like, help him and give him vibranium now that he's weakened and basically dying. And he's like, no, I'll. I thought this was a very clunky line of dialogue, but he was just like, no, like this, my ancestors on ships and something about that. And then he died.
It's a very clunky line.
It's so clunky.
I found it effective. I don't know.
I did not. I kind of laughed. but I get it. But like it, what I liked about it is that it takes a little elements of both. By the end of the movie, is that we can understand, I think, to some extent, T'Challa's hesitance to embrace what Nakia and what Killmonger have wanted, which is to go out there, because again, yes, like that once they open themselves up, you do have that happening. You have people trying to come in, but at the same time, it does take away at the end. It's like, well, they're actually going to take some of what he said, and apply it to what they're doing.
Well, okay, this is my one beef with the film. So the solutions is community centers, that's the solution. You know, I did kind of feel a certain way about that, because I'm like, you with all your power and all your vibranium, your solution is like opening up centers around the country.
Well, what would you want? They're not just going to go and like give them a handout of vibranium and like go do what you want to do.
It just felt very like after school. I don't know. That was the one thing where I was just like, but I don't know. What do you think, Jamal?
I mean, thinking in terms of the characters, you know, what Nakia wants is sort of a humanitarian Wakanda. What Killmonger wants is like an activist, sort of almost like a neocon Wakanda. And T'Challa seems not quite splitting the difference, like definitely going in Nakia's direction. But he's also the Black Panther, so presumably he'll be like kind of, you know, working in world affairs that way. But I think what the conclusion he comes to, that right now the best thing Wakanda can do is go to, because they set up this center in Oakland, so go to those places where Black people are suffering and try to provide them with the tools and resources to advance without violence. That seems like a fair split in terms of kind of finding an equilibrium here.
Yeah, it also just seemed like this was a theme that I think comes up a lot in a lot of Black movies, is this idea of, you know, the upwardly mobile Black people who made it, and what they owe to the ghetto, or what they owe to the hood or the community. It's something that comes up a lot. I guess every sort of piece of literature, movie, or even music about when it comes to Black identity, it reminds me I'm going to plug myself, but I just wrote a piece about this movie I discovered that we actually mentioned in our episode on Friday.
In Represents episode on
Represents episode on Friday, about Abar, the first Black Superman. It's a blaxploitation flick, came out in 77, and the basic crux of the story is a doctor who moves into a white neighborhood being coerced by Abar, who is a sort of Black Panther figure, a leader of this revolution that's sort of like the Black Panthers. And he's like, you need to come back to the hood, and you need to like, or actually it's the ghetto because it was the 70s. You need to come back to this ghetto and like contribute to your brothers and sisters. You can't live here. You need to live there. And I was kind of surprised to see that sort of same strain in a Marvel movie. even Wonder Woman, I feel like, didn't dig that deeply into its feminist aspect. Like, it was feminist in the way it did things, but not as, like, overtly and as, dare I say it, sometimes it did feel a little preachy. I guess the ending, I guess I agree with you to some extent, is that the ending felt a little after school special.
Yeah.
Carolyn, the more I think about it, I was just like, okay.
I kind of see... I see where they're going with this, because part of Killmonger's sort of grievance was that, was specifically about living under white supremacy, right? Like,
yeah.
I am a Wakandan who grew up under white supremacy, and you owe something to black people who grew up under white supremacy. And so I see, and that's where, you know, T'Challa's uncle was died. I mean, I see why they do it in Oakland. I want to say real quickly, so black people aren't the only people going to be watching this movie. This is going to be a huge movie. I mean, the fact that I think we can all agree it's good, it kind of really adds to the fact that this will be a huge movie. And it's going to have, you know, probably the majority of audience goers are going to be white. And the extent to which the film doesn't really condemn Killmonger's basic premise, or grants him his premise and says you're going too far, but doesn't really dispute that yes, Wakandans do owe something to the rest of the world that suffers from the racism. I don't think I've seen anything that pointed in this kind of blockbuster before.
I agree.
Something that's directly challenging its audience.
I do think to some extent that pointed nature for, I think, a lot, if not the majority of white people or like non-black people who will see this movie. I think the fact that we do have one good quote-unquote white character really sort of like tempers that and helps make that seem not as pointed, or at least would balance it out for, I think, a lot of white audiences. Had that character not been there, had this been like a Get Out situation where like all the spoiler if you haven't seen Get Out, but come on, it's a year now, like where none of the white people are good, I think that it helps that we have someone, and he literally, like, he's flying shit. Like,
yeah.
Everett's
like
character.
He's putting himself on the line, which is like...
He's sacrificing himself. Yeah.
Can I say that I think the movie copped out by not having him die during that scene?
Yeah.
That would have been powerful.
Yes.
symbolic in a lot of ways.
Yes, because the people of color are always dying.
They're always sacrificing their lives for everyone else.
That almost happened in Force Awakens. Or not Force Awakens, The Last Jedi, but it didn't, thankfully.
Right.
But
having a character be incredulous about Wakanda, then come to realize what it is, and then come to feel that he ought to defend it.
Yeah.
Not out of any glory, but for the good of the Wakandans, and then having him die in the process of that, I think that would have been good, like story wise.
Yeah.
Same.
But of course, I mean, the reason why he's not dead—I don't know this for certain, but I'm like 90% sure it's true—is that the Marvel movies for this next sort of phase, they kind of need a kind of blandish audience viewpoint character to carry through the various franchises. In the previous movies, it was Agent Coulson, played by the actor I can't remember, but he died in the Avengers. And so Everett Ross is that the new version of this character who kind of touches each franchise and acts as a bit of connective tissue between them.
Wow. And I feel like we were doing an injustice if we don't mention just how like on point all the black women were in this film. Like, I went to go see Marissa Martinelli represent social media assistant. Woo woo. And I was like, why are black women always on the right side of history? Like,
I mean, just to add to that, I'm using the word first a lot because there are a lot of firsts in this movie.
Yeah.
This is the first of these superhero movies, period. Across, not just Marvel, but across the genre, where women aren't just a major part of the story and plot, but they drive the story and plot.
Yep.
That they are central characters whose actions have weight on what happens going forward. This is as much Lupita's movie as it is Chadwick Boseman's movie or Michael B. Jordan's movie. And you really cannot say... I mean, Wonder Woman is really the only other movie that you can say that for.
And she was amongst, like, a bunch of men.
So
it was, like, her.
Half the speaking cast are black women.
Yeah. Well... I feel like there's obviously so much more we could have talked about, but I think we got into the politics, there are so many other, we could have talked about like this being a Black American movie in many ways that's supposed to. There's that whole.
Yeah, is Lupita the only African
no,
actor?
No, Denai is.
No, Denai. Daniel Kaluuya okay. is African.
Okay.
Although.
He's British.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but he's.
But he's African. Yes. Well, I mean, everyone's African, but yes.
But he's not a Black person.
Can I ask you both as Black Americans, like, how do you feel about the argument? I know we have to go, but like, how do you feel about the argument that like, Africans sold my ancestors into slavery? And I feel like, does there any of that?
For me, first of all, just as like a matter of historical record, the initial trading in the 17th century and early 18th century did involve African tribesmen, you know, selling defeated enemies to the Portuguese and to the French and to the British and whomever. But by the time you get to the heyday of the slave trade in the late 18th century, that's just straight up theft, right? It's just like it's raids, it's that kind of thing. So, I mean, for me, it's like slavery is bad, obviously, but I'm not sure one should hold those African tribal leaders in West Africa hold them responsible for the global, you know, the transatlantic slave trade.
Also everyone had like all the cultures, the different places outside of Africa also had slaves. Like it wasn't the African slave owners or people who were selling slaves. They weren't doing it based on race. It was like
these
like you said, these are my enemies, they're defeated, or you know, these are, you know, my tribesmen. It was not that it was good by any means, and thankfully we've mostly evolved, but it wasn't like insidious in the way that it was when it came down to the caste system and race and all that stuff. So it's
like, yeah, slavery has existed on all continents through all times, but racial caste chattel slavery is an American innovation. And so the idea, I encounter this a lot just because you get a lot of whataboutism from people who are like, well, slavery wasn't that bad.
I know.
So the idea that there ought to be equal responsibility just doesn't traffic with me. We should be accurate. We should be accurate about the history that, yes, African tribes sold other Africans into slavery, but that was distinct from what happened in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't have any hard feelings towards Africans. Yeah. To sum up your question,
to be honest, the only hard feelings I ever have is towards people who denigrate Black Americans.
Mm-hmm. That's when it becomes a problem.
So we're definitely going to link to this documentary that I sent you both called "Bond: African versus African Americans." Because I think it does a good job to talk about it from both sides of the coin. Because I've heard it from both. I've heard it from family members that are like, Verilyn, don't behave like those Black Americans. And I've also heard it from like my Black American friends that don't know that I'm African saying like really messed up things about other Africans around me. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
Anyway. Thanks for listening.
I hope you're fully spoiled.
Thank you, Jamel, for joining us.
No, my pleasure.
And thank you, Verilyn.
Of course.
And thanks, everyone else, for listening. Please subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed. And if you like the show, please rate and review it in the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have suggestions for movies or TV shows we should spoil, or if you have any other feedback you'd like to share, please send it to spoilers@slate.com. And for more Black Panther coverage, of which we have done a lot, check out Represent at slate.com/represent. Our producers are Daniel Schrader and Verilyn Williams. For Jamel and Verilyn, I'm Aisha Harris. Thanks for listening.